Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Check the scoreboard. Cleveland 3, Niners essentially infinity. That was not a win. That was a statement. That was a coming out party. In prime time, the entire nation looking on, the rest of the league looking on, and the Niners put on a freaking show. If you did not know about the Niners before last night, now you know. If you thought they were only undefeated because they hadn't played anybody, you needed all of one play from scrimmage to know that they are no joke.
In an offset eye, they move Juszczyk to the right. They wind it back. Great block by Juszczyk. Breed at the second level. He may go.
Goodbye.
But Sheed is loose. 30, 20, 10, 5, touchdown!
Boom!
San Francisco!
Boom is right. 49ers radio. 83 yards and a bunch of next-gen stats that will not tell you more than what your eyes already told you, that Matt Breida is fast. Man, really, really fast. I'm not sure what Cleveland's Demarius Randall was thinking on that play, but I know what he was not doing, and that was running down Matt Breida. That's how you start your first possession of a primetime game at home, and capping it off with a wave to the guys who were chasing him was perfect. And it only got worse. It only got worse for Cleveland, and it only got better for San Francisco, because the very first play after the Niners kicked off was this.
He has Chubb to his side, an RPO, fakes the handoff. Bosa's got him around the waist. He throws, intercepted by Richard Sherman, dropping back into coverage at midfield. Gets up, breaks a tackle, runs back into Cleveland territory, dropped on the Brown 41-yard line. How do you like this start?
Uh-oh! An 83-yard TD run followed by an INT is a suboptimal start on the road. And it continued to spiral. And then when it was over, the Niners were up 31-3, and they had their best win in years. And as good as the Niners were last night, the Browns were that bad. Actually, the Browns were worse. They were a disaster. The offensive line was a turnstile. Mayfield was running for his life the entire game. Antonio Callaway was a catastrophe. They're still committing penalties, dumb penalties, and they're still making mistakes. Everything that could go wrong did go wrong, and then a few more things went wrong even after that. But no, I'm not even going to ask. I'm not even going to dignify you losers and ask whether or not it's time to hit the panic button. Because it's not. It's still a long season. You don't win a Super Bowl in October. They were in first place in the division 3 days ago. There is no reason to lose your bleep yet. Besides, you know me. I'm a glass half full guy. I'm all about keeping it positive. And the positive is Frisco is back with a vengeance. This is the San Francisco team that John Lynch and Kyle Shanahan expected. They're fast. They're explosive. They have unbelievable play calling. But you knew that'd be the case with Shanahan. But what you may not have known or expected is the physicality that they play with. That crew is violent on both sides of the ball. And they're tough as hell. How many times did they run through the first contact? How many times did you see George Kittle catch a third down pass short of the sticks and drag guys past the first down marker? Kittle's a beast, and he should be more of a star than he already is. And if they keep winning the way they did last night, he will be. And so will a bunch of guys on defense, starting with Nick Bosa. This guy had a season last night. Four tackles, two sacks, two tackles for loss, five quarterback hurries, a forced fumble, and a fumble recovery. Oh, and one flag plant. Well, actually, two flag plants. There was the imaginary plant after the sack, and then the real one after the game.
I was kind of trying to talk. I don't usually talk, but this game, he had it coming. So, but he didn't say one word back. So,
what would you say, just an example?
I don't know. I was just screaming his name, like, Baker, Baker, you good? Come on, pick it up. We want a challenge. Like, stuff like that.
So this was throughout the game, not just on
yeah, and he was just looking at me like,
Hey, man, that comes with the territory, right? If that's true, Bosa, a guy who does not talk very much, if he was out there actually serenading Mayfield with Baker.
You good? We want a challenge.
Come on, pick it up. We want a challenge. I mean, if that's true, that's strong. That is strong. And so is the rest of that Niner defense. They get after the quarterback. They have not allowed a rushing TD all season, and they've got a lot of attitude, a lot of swagger, and they can put immense pressure on a QB with only their front four. And as we've seen time and time again this season, if you can get after the quarterback, the Browns are in big trouble. Mayfield is a baller, but he's not making plays lying on his back. Nobody is. So the Niners were looking to send a message and to make a statement. They were looking to make a statement about themselves and about the Browns, because it's pretty clear that a bunch of Niners did not like the Browns, and Mayfield in particular, going into that game, and that went to another level after the pregame handshake. Richard Sherman told Mike Silver, quote, "What's amazing and annoying was him not shaking hands at the beginning. That's some college bleep. It's ridiculous. We're all trying to get psyched up, but shaking hands with your opponent, that's NFL etiquette. And when you pull Bush League stuff, that's disrespectful to the game. And believe me, that's going to get us fired up." End quote. It sure as hell did. Now, I know there's a nation of haters who are ready to jump all over Mayfield for that. But take it from me, Cleveland did not lose that game because Mayfield wouldn't shake hands with Richard Sherman before that game. They lost it because they played terribly, and they played terribly against a really good team. They made mistakes in every possible way that you can make a mistake. And they did it against a fired-up team in prime time that had a lot to prove. And speaking of proving things, Sherman had a message for all the doubters.
Don't flip-flop with us. Like, if you said we weren't going to make it, you said we were some way early on, just stick with that position. Hold it. Don't try to give us credit now. Don't try to give us credit now. Just stick. If you had us ranked 25, keep us ranked 25. If you had us going home early, if you had us going 3-3 and whatever, have us going 3-whatever. You know what I mean? At least stick by your word, because I want you to sound like an idiot at the end. You know, we know what we got in the building.
Man, Sherm. Sherm's still Sherm. Sherm is still making plays. Sherm is still leading from the front. And Sherm still ain't having any of that. My man's not saying, oh, there's plenty of room on this bandwagon. Jump on right now. The train's pulling out of the station. My man is saying, hey, if you didn't see it before, you stick to your previous take. We don't want you around here. He said, quote, "We know what we have in this building. What they have in that building is a ton of talent, a ton of speed, a ton of toughness, and a ton of confidence. And if you didn't know that about them before, now you do. And don't look now, but the NFC West is the best division in football. Styles make fights. Everybody knows that. And anyone who had watched the Browns knew that Niners D-line was going to be a nightmare matchup. Joe Thomas ain't walking through that door. And hell, even if he did, they'd probably need a few of him in his heyday to stop that nasty ass pass rush. I still think ultimately the Browns are going to be fine, but this is about what the Niners have. The present and the future is bright for the Lobsters kid and my man John Lynch. Hey, Kyle, I got to give it to you. You are making your old man proud. Come on, Lobster. Enjoy this with your kid. Why are you looking so red still? Relax, Pops. This is fun. See the Lobster kind of scurrying up over to his kid, dropping his claw over his shoulder. Way to go, Junior. Good win, son. Great play calling. I'd shake your hand, son, but somebody's got rubber bands on my clamps or on my claws. Why are you looking so red, Pops? Your kid's killing it. Man, they looked awesome. The Browns looked horrible. Are you craving some protein after a good workout? Do not make a shake. Do not eat a bar. grab a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper. Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty. It's tender. It's made with real strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a wood fire. And it goes wherever you go, to the game, to the gym, to the beach. Look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. You can see the quality you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. Clones, if you don't see it, ask for it by name, because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? There's video of Baker Mayfield, in fact, shaking Richard Sherman's hand before that game. Sherman made a point afterwards of saying, look, you got to respect the game. You can't not shake our hand. I'm all about rivals, but you got to respect the game. And you got to shake each other's hands. And then Sherman kind of went off on this thing about how, what's the guy really done? What's the guy won? How many games has he won? It's not like the guy was Patrick Mahomes. And Sherm gave him the business. Sherm let him have it. But now you see video before the game where Baker's kind of dapping guys up, and he did shake his hand. So I'm not exactly sure what happened. Something must have happened. There must have been something that happened that Sherm didn't like. But my thing about Richard Sherman, and again, this is a big Baker Mayfield house, obviously. This is also a big Richard Sherman house. I love Sherm. I think that Sherm is just in Sherm mode, all right? He's playing for an undefeated team. They've got a killer defense. He made a big-time play early in that game to help set the tone. He likes where he's at. He's a leader on that team, a leader in that locker room. I mean, my man is in Sherm mode. He probably was looking around for Aaron Andrews after that game like, hey, man, come talk to me. I got a few things I want to share with you. So I don't know exactly what was said or what was done. Maybe Sherman already made up his mind about Baker Mayfield before then. Like maybe he brought that with him into the game. Maybe he already didn't like his act. I think a lot of those guys did not like Baker's act before that game. Then they made plays and let him hear about it. I don't know. But the video would appear that Baker is in that pregame huddle or when the guys, the captains come together, and he's dapping guys up. So I don't know why Sherm said what he said, except to say there was something that had him off. There was something that made him upset. Whether it was right then and there or prior to the game, I don't know. But I know this. Sherm is in Sherm mode. Much ado about nothing. Much ado about nothing. All I care about is the scoreboard. And the scoreboard reads, Cleveland 3. In San Francisco, a hell of a lot more. And a humiliating beatdown on the big stage in prime time. Another bad look for the Browns and a really good look for the Niners, who are back and back with a vengeance. Very good friend of the program, too. Ryan Holiday joins us once again. Ryan, good to have you back. How are you?
Yeah, I'm great. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you, Ryan. All right, so in many ways, stillness is the key. Might be viewed as the third part of a trilogy on Stoicism, although it's not purely about Stoicism. It's about other schools of thought as well. But for those who do not know, what is Stoicism and how did you first get exposed to it?
So Stoicism is ancient philosophy. It comes to us from Greece and Rome, but it's popular even back then with athletes, with elite soldiers, with politicians, with statesmen. It's a philosophy not sort of for the classroom, but for people who are doing real things in the real world, who have to manage their emotions, who have to deal with stress, who have to rise above pain and hardship and difficulty. So it's this, you know, enduring perennial philosophy that today has this resurgence in a lot of the same domains, you know, including professional sports.
We're talking to Ryan Holiday. Now, The Obstacle is the Way was an enormous hit, especially among the Patriots and the Seahawks. Am I correct in thinking that initially you thought the audience for that book would be in the world of business? And if so, what was your reaction when it started to catch fire in sports?
Yeah, I mean, it would have been absurd to think, hey, this, you know, this book about an obscure school of ancient philosophy is really going to resonate with NFL coaches. But that's exactly what happened, and it's been surreal. And I think what it showed me is, one, I was being a little close-minded, but two, in sports, it's the mental edge, the spiritual edge that people need more than anything else, because so many of the other gains have already been reached. We've sort of, I don't want to say we're at peak physical conditioning, but you know, you're not going to get 10% stronger than the other team at this point. It's all evenly matched, but you can bounce back from a loss better than other teams. You can manage, you know, the high pressure stakes of a game better than another team. You can deal with bad referees better than another team, you know, on down the line.
Ryan Holiday is joining us. His new book, Stillness is the Key, is out right now. Now, you spoke to the Browns during training camp. You spoke to the coaching staff of the Rams. What was your message to the Browns and to the Rams coaches?
Well, so when I spoke to the Browns, one of the things we were talking about is ego. That's a team that's got all the talent that you need, but how are they going to come together as an organization and as a group? How are they going to deal with all of the expectations that team has after having, you know, such low expectations for so long? And you can see they're sort of running a wild organization there in a good way. It's a sort of a different way of managing a team, but very easily that sort of system can spiral out of control. So we talked about sort of how we manage our emotions, how we focus on the things that matter, how we don't listen to hype, how we don't listen to criticism. You know, in a way, this is standard stuff, but at that level, you know, one little mantra or one little insight can be the difference between, you know, making it all the way or not making it all the way. And I think the Rams are interesting because, you know, how it seems to happen quite often, a team will make it all the way to the Super Bowl and just, you know, sort of just barely not pull it off. And it's almost the last you hear of them. It's sort of the high watermark of a franchise. And so with the Rams, it was like, you know, how do you get back to basics? How do you focus on what matters? How do you not let the near runness of the last year weigh on you, but at the same time, not let the pain and the frustration of that go to waste?
Ryan Holiday is a best-selling author. His new book is Stillness is the Key. It's out right now. In addition to speaking to those teams, Ryan, you spoke at the NFL owners meeting, and you described looking at that audience, and you see head coaches, and you see the GMs. But then, as you've said, there are 32 team CEOs, and each of them is, quote, their own cartoon version of a billionaire. Lay it out for me. What do you mean by that, and what's it like talking to a room of people like Jerry Jones, Mark Davis, and the rest of that crowd?
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating, right? It's a minimum of 30 billionaires. But from radically different sort of walks of life, even among billionaires. You've got Jerry Jones on one hand, and you've got families who own teams and it's all they own. And then you've got Stan Kroenke, who the Rams are one of like five teams that he owns. And so, you know, we tend to think that people are all the same, but there's this sort of radical diversity even amongst elite performers. And well, one of the things I take from that is there's lots of ways to get to where you want to get. You don't have to. It's interesting that I think the instinct a lot of us have when we want to be successful is we sort of model ourselves exactly on one person. And the truth is often you get to extreme success by sort of fully embracing who you are, your own sort of unique way of doing it. This is obviously something I think as an author. You don't write books that sell by mimicking other books. You write books that don't exist, that need to exist. And that was, you know, when you look at someone like Shad Khan and then you compare him to, you know, a more button-down owner of a different team, you're like, oh, these are just people doing their own thing.
We're talking to Ryan Holiday. You know, Ryan, when I think about the athletes I've interviewed over the years, one of the reoccurring themes, and it comes up over and over again, is the athletes who were passed over or doubted or criticized, whether it was colleges recruiting them or maybe the NFL draft or NBA draft or free agency or pretty much anything like that. They use slights as motivation. They run on that kind of fuel. What do you make of that approach?
Well, I think it works in the short term, right? And I've experienced that in my own life. You want to sort of shove it in the face of the people that doubted you. And you know, a great coach like Belichick, it seems like Belichick is always searching for slights, if not outright manufacturing them to keep the team hungry. I think the problem is when we internalize this at a personal level, the Jordan Hall of Fame speech is a great example. Like, here's this guy, the finest moment of his career, he's receiving the best honor of his career, and he like can't stop himself from sort of vomiting out all these grudges he's accumulated over the years. So anger and grudges and resentment, it can be a powerful fuel, but it's also, I would say, very volatile, and I would say it's deeply corrosive. So it tends to eat at the vessel that's containing it. And I'm sure you've seen this in your career. Like, it can work, but the problem is, what happens if it gets you where you want to get? Now, all of a sudden, instead of being happy, you're manufacturing new slights to keep going, and you never enjoy where you are. And often you end up undermining the really good thing you have going.
Really interesting. Ryan Holiday is joining us. So then where do you come out when it comes to Nick Saban? As an example, Ryan, one of the stories that we tell ourselves as a society is the story of never, ever be satisfied. And then you've got Nick Saban always complaining that celebrating a national championship gets in the way of recruiting. Is that a good and healthy story for us to be telling ourselves?
Yeah, look, I think it's complicated, and I don't know him super well, so it's always dangerous when you're sort of speculating about people's psychology. I guess the question is, like, is it that he doesn't want to celebrate and he wants to go off and recruit because he feels like the next championship will be the one that matters, or is it that he genuinely loves the thrill and the chase of the recruiting? Like, I was thinking about Kevin Durant leaving the Warriors. You know, the sort of speculation is he wants to win a championship on his own. If he thinks that, hey, if I win one in New York, it's somehow going to be different and better, and this one will mean something, I think he's going to be sorely disappointed. If he's saying, look, I don't want to just play on a team where a championship is a foregone conclusion, where we're always a contender because we're so overwhelmingly talented, I want to earn it, I want to do it differently, I'm looking forward to the challenge, I think that's a different way to think about it. And so that, to me, that's the tension. Why you want to keep going and you want to improve, but is it because you're lying to yourself and you're saying it's different this time, or are you doing it because you genuinely, as Saban says, you love the process?
Ryan Holiday has got a brand new book. It's called Stillness is the Key. Ryan, before you go, like, on a really very real level, there are a few things that are going to interfere with stillness more than your phone, your screen time. How do you go about dealing with your phone to make sure that you're not, you know, a monk who's completely cut off from everybody,
sure,
but at the same time, you could still find time for stillness? What kind of rules do you have for that?
I've got an easy one I started doing about 6 months ago. So I don't touch my phone for the first 1 hour that I'm awake. So, and another easy hack related to that is, like, don't sleep with your phone in the room. So you can't check it at night. Give yourself, like, 8 hours or 7 hours of no phone. But the big one is I don't touch it right when I wake up. So I want to have some level of peace and quiet. I don't want to start the day on my back foot based on whatever happened on Twitter over the, while I was in bed, you know, whatever unsolicited emails or text messages or phone calls I got. I want to start the day where I'm in control. I don't want to start reactive. So that's number one. And look, number two is, like, you got to remove what social media you can from your phone. You don't need to have all of them on there. You can do some of them on the desktop, like, or you can set it up on a separate phone if you're one of those people that's got multiple phones. Like, I think carrying around access to an unending amount of information and an unending amount of conflict and arguing and status signaling is just a recipe for unhappiness.
Ryan Holiday, my guest. All right, so what about this? What would you say to somebody who is listening right now and says, I'm working all the time, I have to have my phone with me all the time, it is impossible, Ryan, to find stillness?
I don't think that's true, because when you look at, you know, a team in this, when you look at New England being 28-3 in the Super Bowl, what I saw in that fourth quarter was stillness amidst, you know, obviously millions of people watching, hundreds of thousands of people there on the ground, unending pressure, an incredibly difficult task in front of them, people trying to tackle them. You know, what you do is you slow it down, you tune out what doesn't matter, you become fully present, you focus on the task in front of you, and you just sort of check one box off at a time. And look, I'm on tour right now for the book. That's exactly what I'm trying to do. I'm not trying to get too concerned about what just happened, not trying to worry about what happens next, trying to tune out the inessential and just, you know, knock it out of the park each, like, individual task I got in front of me.
And then one last thing. One of the things you've talked about is this notion of if-then statements. If I do this or get that, then I'll be happy, or my dad will be proud of me. How dangerous are those statements?
Yeah, look, that you can see why that, like, hey, if I just discover this new continent, if I just make $1 billion, if I just, we can see why that's good for the species evolutionarily, but it's not good for the individual human. And like, there's no internal problem will ever be solved with external success, right? If you can't earn these things that you want, you have to you find that sort of quietly sitting with yourself. You find it, you know, reading, or you find it going to church, or you find it going to therapy. Like, no amount of Super Bowl rings, no Supermax contract, you know, no amount of Twitter followers is going to make you feel good inside if you don't already have it, right? And so that's what this work that we're talking about is. And I think ultimately that's why, you know, sports teams are thinking about this stuff too, because they're trying not just to be good on the field or on the court, but you know, sort of holistically as people, because it spills over into the thing they do professionally.
This thinking, these philosophies have been huge in the sporting world. I will tell you this, and I did tell you this already, but I want to reiterate. Before I sent my son to college, he read The Obstacle is the Way, and my son Jake, who is 18, said, "Dad, that is the best thing I've ever read. That was the perfect book for me to read at the perfect time," and I sent him to college with that, and it was so good for him. So this is the kind of thinking that can affect so many different people in so many different places. He is a best-selling author. The titles do include The Obstacle is the Way, Conspiracy, Ego is the Enemy, all great reads, and his latest book is Stillness is the Key, which is out right now. Ryan Holiday, my guest. Ryan, great job, and it's always good to have you in the jungle.
Thanks, man.
New York did what New York always does to Minnesota, ended their season, and they did it in a hurry. This time was supposed to be different. It wasn't. The Twins have now lost 13 straight postseason games to the Yanks. I mean, that's like, what's the word for that? Help me out, clones. What's the word for that? Disgusting. Incredible. It's amazing, actually. 13 games, no wins. And those are not bad Twins teams either. And those were not all amazing Yankee teams either. 13 games. You'd think they'd stumble into one win. I mean, that's not easy to do. But they did. 13 straight. And the Twins were supposed to have the bats to compete with the Yankees, but they didn't. The team that had the great regular season that set the Major League record for home runs saw their run end in three straight. Three games that were not even competitive. 10-4, 8-2, last night 5-1 in Minnesota. So it's a reminder that while the Yankees are not perfect, and they're not, they've got holes. They've got holes in their rotation. They've got holes in their swings. They're not perfect, but they're tough. They're really tough. They just outscored the best home run hitting team in history by a margin of 23-7. So the next round in the American League is half set. The next round in the National League is still wide open, thanks to Washington and St. Louis. You never want to be the team on the verge of elimination. But if you are, it's not bad to have Max Scherzer pitching. And he did exactly what you'd expect him to do in that spot. Seven innings, seven strikeouts, four hits, one run allowed in a season-saving performance in the Nats 6-1 win. And he did all of that on short rest. The Nationals had their hearts ripped out by the Dodgers and their two-out and two-strike hitting in Game 3. But Scherzer was not going to let that happen again, not on his watch. This is the same guy who allegedly went to the manager, Dave Martinez, in Game 3 and said, "Let me pinch hit. Let me pinch run. Let me pitch in relief. In other words, use me any way you want." This guy's a freaking gamer. He's a beast. Justin Turner jumped ship in the first inning, and that was all there was. That was all Scherzer after that. This guy was all in. He left everything he had out there. I wouldn't be surprised at all if he said, "Give me the ball in Game 5. I can give you something." Listen to him on this strikeout of Gavin Lux to end the fourth. Runner on second, 1-1 game. Scherzer goes hard.
He muscled up on that one.
Two sounds. Scherzer grunting and the ball hitting the glove.
He muscled up on that one.
Is he finishing a hitter? Or dry heaving into a bucket.
He muscled up on that one.
Muscling up and finishing a batter. Or dry puking into a bucket.
He muscled up on that one.
Since we're talking about sounds, check out the sound on this from Ryan Zimmerman, who broke the game open in the bottom of the fifth.
Right-hander kicks, delivers, Zim swings and drives one in deep center field. Way back goes Bellinger to the warning track, to the wall. It is gone! Goodbye! Bang! Zoom goes Zimmerman!
Did you hear the way that sounded when the ball left the bat? You could tell that was not just a three-run home run. That was a three-run moonshot. That was a bomb. Listen to the way that sounded. So, thanks to two old dudes in Nats gear, Washington is now coming out here to Cali to play a winner-take-all Game 5. Steven Strasburg v. Walker Buehler. Is that matchup any good? And if you didn't see this coming, you probably should have. Because as an MLB executive told Jeff Passan months ago, when the Nats looked like they were circling the drain, quote, "The only thing that's going to stop the Dodgers is the Nationals in a short series," end quote. And this is when the Nats, that comment was made when I think they were 19-31. They looked like they were going nowhere. And that executive told Passan, yeah, I wouldn't count these guys out. And not only that, you don't want to see them in a short series. This is why Dodger fans, so many of them wanted Milwaukee instead of Washington, because the Nats are a bad matchup. A bad matchup in a short series, and not just for LA, but for anybody because of their pitching. A bad matchup because a short series means you're going to get a steady diet of Scherzer and Strasburg. Anytime you're seeing a lot of a three-time Cy Young Award winner and a three-time All-Star in a short period of time, anything can happen. Tomorrow night, Game 5 here in L.A., anything can happen. The Dodgers have won seven straight divisional titles. They've lost back-to-back in the World Series twice. Anything short of a ring is going to be a big disappointment. A loss in the division series would be pretty much calamitous. So Game 5, you want to lock that in. Can't wait. And speaking of insanity, there's more. Speaking of insanity and anything that could happen, might happen, don't for a moment sleep on Atlanta and St. Louis, because that has become very spicy in a very short period of time. You'll remember after St. Louis won Game 1, members of both teams were actually pissed about Ronald Acuna Jr. Then after Atlanta won Game 3 to take a 2-1 lead, Acuna went with a gesture that seemed to bother Yadier Molina. Wait, sorry, did I say seemed to bother Yadi? I meant really pissed off Yadi. At least it sure looked that way when Molina stepped into the batter's box in the bottom of the 10th of a 4-4 game yesterday. He'd already tied the game up in the bottom of the 8th with a 2-out single. Now he's at the plate in the 10th. One out. Runners on first and third. Alvey, roll it.
Teron deals. Molina in the air. Left field. Duvall's got a great arm, but that is deep. Long, ready to run. He tags. Here he comes. Duvall's throw. No chance. And the Cardinals have won Game 4. Fire that bat, Yachty. We're going to a Game 5, partner. This is something special.
Turner Sports. Sack fly. Ball game, bat toss, and the subsequent throat slash. Man, that's a hell of a way to end a game. There's so much going on there. The fact that Molina had the absolute perfect sack fly to score Colton Wong to win the game. And then there's the fact that after he did it, he ran the bat with him down the first baseline. He rounded first base, and then he fired the bat into the outfield.
Fire that bat, Yachty.
Yachty fired the bat into the outfield. I mean, there's flipping your bat, and then there's running it up the first baseline and chucking it into the outfield. When was the last time you saw somebody fire their bat into the outfield after a critical plate appearance? The answer is never. That's the best thing I've seen since Lou Piniella dug second base out of the ground, ran it into the outfield, and fired it over the center field wall. Nothing will ever top that. But this was pretty damn good. I'm not even sure that thing's landed yet. Molina said it himself.
I don't know. I mean, I lost it right there. I think I tossed the bat over there in the bullpen.
I think I tossed the bat into the bullpen. It'd been so great if he had thrown the bat out of the stadium, into the parking lot. That made Joey Bat's epic bat toss look like he just gently laid it down. Do you remember how much heat Joey Bat's got for that? Now you've got guys running bats into the outfield and launching them. Because that was not a toss, that was a launch. He was trying to chuck that bat out of the stadium. And then on top of that, to chase it with a throat slash, which seemed to be a response to Acuna. Now, I've said it before and I'll say it again. I do not claim to be an expert on the MLB code and all the rules that are written in invisible ink. But there's got to be some clause or some footnote about a bat toss that goes all the way to the outfield and then is chased by a throat slash gesture. Then again, how would I know? I stopped playing baseball in Little League. And unless you play the game at the highest level, there is no way you can interpret their code. Only they know the code. But here's what I do know. Even if he did violate the code, even if he did disrespect the game, at this point, I don't give a damn. Because I'm here to tell you, a dude running his bat up the first baseline and then chucking it into the outfield after a game-winning sack fly and then chasing it with a throat slash is one of the better things I've seen in baseball in a long time. That may bother some of you. It might bother some of you, and it might bother all of the old school, but that does not bother me at all. Fire that! In fact, I need more of that. And now we have a Game 5 tomorrow in the ATL. Let's get it. And you got Acuna, who is just electric. The guy's electric, and he's pissing off guys in both clubhouses. And you got a guy like Yadi Molina? I mean, a guy that respected, a vet. Man, this guy is like one of the most respected guys in the game. Throat slashing dudes and running the bat up the baseline with him and chucking it into the outfield. Fire that bat, Yadi. And you're going to cry to me about a violation of the code or the unspoken rules? Man, where was this 10 years earlier? So good. Today's episode of the Jim Rohn Podcast is brought to you by CBS Sports HQ, the brand new streaming sports news network. It's live 24/7. It costs you nothing. That's right. It's sports coverage that's always on and it's always free. Always. And the thing I love best about it, it looks great and it's just the news, man. Straight facts. Not a bunch of baked, manufactured hot takes. Straight news and highlights. CBS HQ's coverage is always focused on the game. Tons of highlights, breaking news as it happens, fantasy advice, and something we care about deeply here, gambling picks and analysis to get the extra edge. Like, I know when I turn on CBS Sports HQ, I'm going to get the tips and the trends that I need to win my bets. And don't forget, you get access to all this amazing coverage completely free. I don't mean free for a week or a month or if you have some kind of special cable package. Totally and completely free for everybody. You don't even need a login. Just download the CBS Sports app on your phone, Apple TV, Roku, Fire TV, or other connected devices at any time to watch CBS Sports HQ. No fake debates. Just sports for real sports fans at the great price of completely free. You don't even have to log in or sign up for anything at all. Just download the CBS Sports app and watch CBS Sports HQ today. Justin Tuck is my guest. Justin, good to have you back. How are you?
What's going on, Jim? How's everything?
Good, good, man. Good to talk to you, Justin. Nice to have you back. Let me start with your Giants really quickly. They've had some energy and some buzz over the last few weeks. Now they've got a Thursday night game against the Patriots. How are you feeling about your team right about now?
I think they're pretty much on par with what I expected from the season. Obviously, like you said, we've got a little energy and a little buzz, given the fact that we might have found our quarterback for the future. Danny Dimes looks promising. I think as we continue to rebuild this thing, I think something that is a positive is that his play and the fact that I feel as though we have the number one running back in the league So there's pieces of the puzzle as far as what the future looks like, but we're not there yet. And obviously, you know, the schedule's not going to get any easier, as you mentioned. We got New England on Thursday up there, and that's going to be, I mean, that's a tall task. But I do like what I've seen from them as far as, you know, putting the pieces together for what the future may look like.
Justin Tuck is joining us. So at the same time, as hyped as everybody is on Jones, a lot of people have been taking their shots at Eli Manning. As somebody who played with him for a long time, what is your reaction when you hear that?
Listen, everyone knows how I feel about Eli, and I get it. He hasn't played up to his caliber or what people came to be accustomed of his play the last couple of years. And, you know, it is what it is, right? He's been the face of that franchise for 15-plus years. What he's been able to accomplish in this league, I think just about any of us would love to switch seats with him. So, yeah, people are taking their shots at him now on his way, you know, out. But, you know, what he has cemented for his legacy in this league stands on his own. And, I just feel as though he's done it the right way. We all wanted to kind of see Eli go out on his white horse as he ended his career. It doesn't look like he's going to get the opportunity to do that, but I'll trade with him. I would love to have what he's been able to accomplish in this league and stand on that and not really worry about all the other noise coming from people outside of that locker room.
Justin Tuck is joining us. Let me ask you about this. One of your former teammates, David Tollefson, recently tweeted a reaction to Vontaze Burfict that included this note, quote, "I'm a guy that loves the physical part of football. Ask the guys I played with. That being said, Justin Tuck once told me, if we as players don't protect each other, who will? It really changed the way I approached how I played," end quote. So where did your philosophy come from in that regards?
Listen, I've always kind of been a guy that did not like hitting people in my head anyway. If you looked at all my helmets, all the years I played, they stayed pretty clean. But no one would ever question the fact that I played with toughness and I played with, you know, passion for, you know, being physical. I just feel as though, unfortunately, somewhere down the line, we misconstrued the message that, you know, the helmet is a weapon. It never was intended to be one. And I'm actually excited with how the NFL has approached this to hopefully take the helmet a little bit out of the game. But listen, it's a fine line. We all signed off for what it is in the NFL, and that's to be physical and be a part of a physical sport. But I think there is definitely a fine line for when you use the, you know, this platform to be endangering other people. From a perspective of, you know, we all understand what the research has told us on what the effects are long term of these type of hits on the head and so on and so forth. So I definitely agree with you know, David. We all are physical players, but we also have a responsibility to take care of each other and make sure that we don't do anything that's gonna, you know, directly have that type of long lasting negative impact on somebody's body. And that comes with it. That comes with the platform. That comes with you signing on that contract. So I definitely agree with what he said there.
Justin Tuck is joining us. Listen, I understand that. I really respect that. I agree with you. That said, as a guy who got after the quarterback, and again, at the same time, you're not looking to hurt anybody, but you got after the quarterback, and what do you make of how the game is being officiated right now as it relates to roughing the passer? I mean, do you know what will be flagged and won't be flagged, or are you as confused as everybody else?
I'm confused. I really am. I get what the NFL is trying to do because the quarterback plays such a big role in the success of this league. But I just don't understand how as a defensive player, you can expect to do some of the things that they're expecting these players to do when in the mix of some of the biggest people on the football field. I mean, defensive linemen have to toe that line, but while also, you know, doing their job and having 300-pounders either holding you, pushing you, or trying to stop you from doing that job, that's a tough task. And, you know, I get it. I get what the NFL is trying to do, but I just don't think they're going about it the right way. And it almost makes it look like, you know, other players aren't valuable because I haven't seen them make a big play on, you know, defensive linemen being cut at the line of scrimmage and some of the other things in this league that I don't necessarily agree with either, but I'm glad I retired when I did because I probably would have been a player that had fell in the trap of getting fined over some of the hits that I've seen in the league. And it definitely made it tough for people who played my position.
Right. In other words, call it both ways, right? Just call it both
Absolutely.
Ways. All right, so you and I have talked numerous times over the years, not just about football, but about life and life away from the field. You earned your MBA from Wharton, and now you're a VP in private wealth management at Goldman Sachs. What has the journey been like overall for you?
I mean, it's been fun. I think it's been intriguing, and it's been challenging to step out of my comfort zone and do something completely different and a complete 180 from what I, you know, previously was known for. I think, you know, given the fact that I had a platform that was the NFL and the New York Giants and Oakland Raiders, it allowed me to meet a lot of interesting people. It allowed me to be in a lot of different, you know, interesting conversations, and I think that's something of the things that have pushed me to go the route that I have, and I'm loving every minute of it.
Right now, you're working with the Mayo Clinic Comeback Player of the Year Award. If we were to go back to your time at Notre Dame, you suffered a serious knee injury at the end of your junior season. What was your mental and physical approach as you came back from that injury?
Yeah, I think mentally it was something that I had never experienced before. I'd never been hurt. I never had the misfortune of missing games. All through high school and up until that point in my career at Notre Dame, I had been, you know, on the football field. So that little stint where I had with the injury and not being able to be on the field was something I had never been used to. And the experience of that is something that I'm trying to lend that experience to these kids that have went through it. I had a knee injury that set me out for all year. I mean, all the offseason, and I didn't handle that the right way, I don't think, now looking back on it. So I'm hopeful that, you know, the kids that we're spotlighting with the Mayo Clinic, I can be a sounding board to them on some of the things that they're dealing with, and hopefully that they don't make the same mistakes as I did.
All right, so finish that thought. What exactly is the Mayo Clinic Comeback Player of the Year Award? What's it about? Who does it honor?
Yes, it's an award that basically is highlighting kids who, similar to me, have had to deal with adversities through injuries or illness and are trying to make the comeback to be the previous athlete or athletes that they were before that injury. And basically what we're just doing is highlighting that, you know, even when you do have these type of adversities, you know, some of the strongest people that I've played with are kids who dealt with this, and the ship don't always sail the way you expect it to. It's a lot of things that go on in this sport where, you know, you got to midstream adjust. So we're honoring 30 players throughout, 30 college football players throughout the season, and that'll all culminate in at the this year's Fiesta Bowl, where we'll have three of our nominees there, and we'll have a winner picked at the Fiesta Bowl this year.
Excellent. Justin Tuck, my guest. Before I let you go, you're a huge Yankee fan. How does the team look to you right now after sweeping the Twins?
I mean, they look awesome. I'm a little afraid is not the right word. I see Houston in our forefront, and the pitching that Houston has is going to be tough. But listen, if we keep, you know, having at bats like we've had in against Minnesota, against Houston, I see no reason why we shouldn't come out of that one as well. But it's going to be tough, and Houston is obviously the team that has been circled on every Yankee fan's calendar when this season started. So we'll get our shot at it.
It looks like it's going to be a collision course between those two. Listen, one last thought. There's a Notre Dame player that I really like and respect. I know you do too, Julian Love. He was a finalist for the Jim Thorpe Award when he was at Notre Dame. He got drafted by the Giants in the fourth round. Over the summer, he said, quote, "It's hard to go to Notre Dame and not know Justin Tuck. He was such a force in the community and dorm life. He was always around the team. And when you see he's the biggest guy there, he's the guy who's done it all on and off the field." So my question for you is, how much pride is there for you in knowing that kind of legacy at Notre Dame and that you still inspire guys to this day at Notre Dame?
I mean, that's big, because I think, you know, unfortunately, a lot of guys that I get to talk to, their focus is solely on being an athlete. And that's, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. But I just knew that given the platform I had, you know, given the people I had around me and the quote-unquote luck and blessings I had to play at a place like Notre Dame and make it there and then make it here in New York City, I definitely wanted to utilize that platform to benefit those that was coming behind me in hopes to be, you know, a sounding board or some type of lending advice or whatever you want to call it to those who was trying to do the same things I did. So to hear Julian say that, it means that I must be doing something right, but also it encourages me to continue to do what I'm doing because people are taking notice and it's being beneficial to, you know, other people, which, you know, if you know anything about me, that's what I'm all about.
I know that's exactly what you're all about. He is a two-time Super Bowl champ as well, a member of the Giants Ring of Honor, the co-founder of Tuck's Rush for Literacy, and today appeared courtesy of the Mayo Clinic Comeback Player of the Year Award. Justin, good to get caught up, man. I appreciate it so much. Always good to have you on the show.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure, man. Anytime.
I'm speaking of Dak Prescott. Dak, it's good to have you back on. How are you?
It's good. It's good. Thank you for having me on, Jim.
Good to have you, Dak. Nice to hear your voice. All right, so you're coming off a tough loss to the Packers. You guys fell behind early on, Dak. You mounted a big comeback late. You gave yourself a shot. As you look back on that game, what kind of thoughts do you have?
It was a tough one. We played a good Packers team, as you said right there. When you play a good team like that, you can't get yourself down like we did right there, going down 21 points earlier, 24 points, and then just having to fight back the whole game. We put ourselves on a hold against a good team. You don't give yourself a chance like that. So we'll bounce back from it. We'll learn from it, and we'll become a better team.
We are talking to Dak Prescott. Now, Dak, from the outside, at least from the outside, the offense seems to feel a bit different this year with Kellen Moore. How different does it feel to you on the inside?
I mean, it's different, but we're definitely doing the things that we've done in the past that we're good at. And that's what's great about Kellen Moore is that he has ways of disguising it with our alignment or with motions. But in all that being said, we're going to get to the plays that we're comfortable in doing. We're going to get to the plays that we've been good at. And it starts with running the ball. And that's just who we are.
We're talking to Dak Prescott. You know, Dak, you mentioned that when something like that happens, that game against Green Bay, you want to put that behind you as quickly as possible. And you've always been a guy, and I want to touch on this in a minute, but you've never gotten too high or gotten too low no matter what's happening. So how do you quickly go about trying to get a game like that out of your system and then start focusing on the Jets on Sunday? How does that work?
Just like you said, I mean, you want to put it behind you. You want to put it behind you quick, and you have to. This is a long season. We have a lot of ball left to play. We've got a good team. We've got to play this week in the Jets, so we can't sit there and dwell on that loss. But for me, you just want to get out there, and you're anxious to put your next performance on tape. But so you have to just make sure that you stay in the now. You don't get too high, and you don't get too low. You stay in and take it day by day. Don't forget the preparation that it takes to lead up to that next game. And just know you got to come back with a strong performance that next time.
Cowboys quarterback Dak Prescott is joining us. Now, you and I have talked a number of times over the years, lots of times. In fact, how different are you as a quarterback now than when you first came into the league? And what are the areas where you notice the biggest difference?
Yeah, I've definitely grown. And that's something I, when I look back at my tape, and you're always self-evaluating and learning from, something I'm proud of, but definitely my footwork, first and foremost. Just from dropping back from under center, being able to put myself in the position to make every throw on the field, and then just consistently getting accurate and focusing on that. I think when those things improve at the quarterback position, everything else falls in place.
You know, Dak, correct me if I'm wrong, but for somebody listening, footwork does not sound like it's that exciting of a thing or that big of a thing, but what have you done to work on it, and how big of a difference does it make to your game?
Yeah, it's very important, but it makes a huge difference. I mean, you look at the numbers and you look at the completion percentage goes up, and it's a tell of that. And it's the people that I work with and the coaches that are pushing me, and I give them a lot of credit. But when you're able to put yourself in a position to make the throw, you give yourself a better chance, and it starts with the footwork.
Talking to Dak Prescott, now guys around you have been talking about how you've always been a leader, but there's this element where you're even more stern now and that you'll let guys know what you expect of them. Is this how you're approaching it? Like, you're going to let guys know about it when they're not meeting expectations. I mean, you'll let them know when they do something right, but if they don't do something right, will you let them hear it now?
Yeah, sure. And I'd hope they'd do the same for me. But that just creates that level of trust and that level of camaraderie or whatever, that focus on that teammate. And that just allows us to just come together and not focus on the flaws and not focus on the bad things, but to be able to confront each other on the good, confront each other, and just put it behind us so we can make sure that we get better. And we have a lot of teammates that accept that. So if we can just hold each other accountable that way, it allows for a healthy relationship and a healthy locker room, and that's what we have.
Yeah, Dak, I've done this a long time, and I've talked to everybody in your position prior to this since I've done this, but I asked the same question. When you're the quarterback of the Cowboys, you're always going to be in the spotlight. That's a really different gig. I mean, that's like being shortstop of the Yankees. A lot of guys think they can handle it, but ultimately they get there and they find out it's not what they thought. How do you go about handling it?
Yeah, I just focus on the things I can control. At the end of the day, that's all that really matters. If I can just focus on that, give all my attention. And right now that's being the quarterback of this team and focusing on the locker room and the things that we have to do to get better on the field. I can't focus this team, me as the quarterback. You can't focus on the outside noise, whether it's good or bad. You just have to know what's important.
How do you do that? I mean, is that just a conscious decision? Dak, for instance, when you guys were 3-0, there was so much hype, and then you lose a couple of games, right, and everybody's coming for you. But like I said, you and I have been talking, going back to your time at Mississippi State. You've always had a really good grasp on this. How do you go about not getting too high or too low?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I focus on the things I can control. All I can control is me moving forward and putting this loss behind me and just knowing that I'm going to come back and we're going to be a better team this Sunday. And it's tough when you give your focus to the outside world. You lose distraction on what's important, and you lose distraction on being that teammate or being that team that you need to be. And when you're the Cowboys, as you said, it's even more focused on that. So I think that just allows us to come together, lock arms closer, and just know that the only thing that matters is what we do and what we focus on as a team and in that locker room.
And then, Dak, one more thing about that. Like, when it comes to the contract, is that the same as everything else? Is that just more noise? Or if you show up every single day and somebody says, where does that stand? And if you show up every week and somebody says, well, his price went up or his price went down, is that something different than everything else?
No, it's not. Once again, it's noise. There's only a few people that know what's going on with that and where that is, the progress we've made and everything. So I'm not necessarily focused on that or listening to what people say. And that just goes in that same category as noise. It's the outside world. It can't do anything for this team, and it can't do anything for me getting better on the field.
And Dak, you get back to your roots. Like, over the summer, you had a number of football camps for kids. What's it like when you show up and these kids are there and they're wearing your shirt and they've got your name on it and they've got your number and they're looking to meet you? They want to spend time with you. What's that feel like?
Yeah, it's a real moment. It makes you flash back to those times when you're a little boy, you're in middle school, and you're playing in the yard, playing with your buddies, and you're imagining you're those quarterbacks that are in the NFL. And for me, that was the Peyton Manning, the Michael Vick. So now to be able to hold those camps and see that, see those kids, imagining that they're me, as you said, wearing my jerseys. It's just a surreal moment. Just allows me to be even, or makes me even be more humble and just thankful for the position that I have.
Dak Prescott, my guest. Dak, you're working with DirecTV and their 4K broadcasts of Thursday Night Football. Lay it out for me. What are you doing with them? How can the fans get involved?
Yeah, well, so for the first time ever, select Thursday night football games, including this week's game with the New York Giants and the New England Patriots, and as well as our Thursday night game against the Bears on December 5th, are going to be broadcasted in crystal clear 4K HDR on DirecTV. And the way that we're celebrating this this feature with the DirecTV's Thursday night football games is we've teamed up. Me and my squad, we've teamed up, and what we're offering is this 4K prize package. It includes a 4K TV, as well as some of my own D4K apparel. So the way fans can enter is go to d4k-suites.com and choose which team they think will win each select Thursday night game, which includes next week's Chiefs and Broncos game. And again, once again, choose the Cowboys on our Thursday night feature as well. And just simple as that, DirecTV will choose one team per week. And as simple as that, make sure you visit, once again, d4k-suites.com and just check out all the 4K action you can on DirecTV Channel 105.
It's as simple as that. Quarterback of the Cowboys, two-time Pro Bowler, two-time first-team All-SEC-er, and appearing courtesy of DirecTV and their 4K broadcast of Thursday Night Football. Dak, good to have you back on the show. Always good to get caught up.
Yep, thank you, Jim.
Good night,